Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking about the science of willpower with Dr. Kelly McGonigal from Stanford University. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki, episode number 135, recorded Thursday, March 1st, 2012. Where there's a will. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and this is the show, as you've come to know, or maybe this is your first time joining into the program. This is the show that we like to dig deep into subjects. I give you an entire hour talking about a single subject in the sciences with an expert in that topic. How often do you get that in the media today? Not too often. Maybe you can watch Charlie Rose, but he's not always talking about science. That's what we do here. Science, 1 hour a week, in-depth discussion. And today is no different. We're going to be getting really, really into a very fun topic that has some personal relevance, maybe to me and to probably each and every one of you out there. I hope that you are ready for it. Get ready to get dirty. We're going to dig into the science of willpower with my guest today, Dr. Kelly McGonigal from Stanford University. And it's going to be a fun show. I am sure of it. But first, as usual, a few science headlines. It's March 1st, 2012, and this is the science that made headlines this week. Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory have confirmed that there is life on Earth by observing reflected light from the moon. The technique is a modification to Earthshine observation. It's called spectropolarimetry. It involves looking at both color and polarization of light from the Earth after being reflected by the moon. The team was able to confirm that the Earth has a cloudy atmosphere and is covered in part by oceans and vegetation. They foresee it being used moving forward to investigate exoplanets for signs of life. The World Wildlife Fund reported that several U.S. supermarkets carry toilet paper and tissue products, which are directly linked to rainforest deforestation in Indonesia. The products are sold under the brand names Paseo and Livy and are owned by Asia Pulp and Paper, or APP. It is estimated that since 1984, APP and its affiliates have pulped close to 5 million acres of tropical forest on the island of Sumatra. Stem cells were isolated from human ovaries and used to create egg cells in the lab. Following on the heels of work showing that viable egg cells could be produced from the stem cells of adult mice, the study used donated human reproductive stem cells to make human egg cells that appear viable. However, since fertilization of human reproductive cells is against the law in the United States, viability is as yet unknown. The groundbreaking study by researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital promises to revolutionize infertility treatments of the future. For the first time since its discovery in 1977, paleontologists have completely reconstructed the skeleton of a 25-million-year-old penguin from the genus Kairuku. The study is published in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology and described a giant yet slender penguin 4 feet, 2 inches tall with long flippers and a long, narrow beak. These ancient birds once lived on the island of New Zealand. Giant fleas were found among fossils in China and Mongolia, dating back to the mid-Jurassic and Cretaceous periods. 9 species in total, the fossilized insects share many traits with modern fleas, but had unique traits, including long claws that might have been used to hang on to fur or feathers, and sturdy mouthparts for stabbing and siphoning. Yummy. Genetic sequencing of the remains of the iceman named Ötzi is allowing scientists to tell a fuller story about the mysterious man. The details published in Nature Communications suggest that Ötzi had brown eyes, type O blood, was likely lactose intolerant as an adult, had cardiac disease risk factors, as well as traces of Lyme disease. So he was pretty sick. And he can be traced to the people of Sardinia in the Mediterranean. Research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences finds that an asexual species of flatworm overcomes aging by increasing the activity of an enzyme named telomerase. Strangely, similar flatworms that reproduce sexually also appear to reproduce indefinitely, but don't seem to have the same telomerase mechanism in place, making the researchers wonder if the sexual worms use an as yet unknown mechanism to fight aging. In an updated analysis of the T-Rex skull, biomechanics researchers conclude that the T-Rex still holds the record for the most powerful bite. After laser scanning a T-Rex skull from the Manchester Museum, the scientists created a 3D model onto which they mapped muscles. By simulating a bite in the model, they were able to estimate the force used or produced when the jaws shut. The maximum forces measured were between 30,000 to 60,000 newtons. It's pretty forceful. The American Society of Microbiology writes that a team from the Translational Genomics Research Institute have traced the history of MRSA strain ST398. Using whole genome sequencing, they found MRSA ST398 started in humans, jumped to pigs, where it gained methicillin resistance, and then jumped back to humans. This is conclusive evidence that farm use of antibiotics does affect drug resistance in bacteria that can affect human health. Australian scientists created the world's first atomic transistor from a single atom of phosphorus positioned on a silicon crystal. The development is being hailed as an important step in the development of the quantum computer. Again, now, IBM reports to the American Physical Society that it has broken 3 records in their attempts to create qubits with integrity, bringing quantum computers just a little closer to reality. In several papers, IBM researchers described a 3-dimensional superconducting qubit setup approaching the minimum standards required for quantum computing. And scientists at IBM Research Zurich imaged the charge distribution of a single molecule for the first time using a technique called Kelvin probe microscopy. The team measured the charge on the molecule naphthalocyanine in such a way as to determine the positions of electrons within the molecule. And that does it for the science news headlines this week. Let me know what you think about these news stories, or tell me what you think should be news by emailing Dr. Kiki at drkiki.tv, or leave me a voicemail, 650-741-KIKI. And now I'd like to thank Netflix for sponsoring this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, hassle, and money. There are several easy ways to instantly access Netflix streaming movies and TV shows. You can watch them on your Mac, your PC, your iPad, if you have an iPad app. If you have the Netflix app on your iPhone, you can watch it on your iPhone. And some Android phones will support Netflix apps as well, which is pretty great if you want to watch on the go or at the gym. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, PS3, Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV through those devices. If you're not a gamer, but you'd like to use another device to watch on your television, you can use some inexpensive and easy-to-use set-top boxes like the Roku Box or Boxy Box or an Apple TV. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can begin watching a movie or show on one device, like at home on your TV. Stop watching at any point if, say, your child starts crying and you have to turn it off and go take care of your child and then come back to it. You don't have to start all over and try and find the spot where you left off again. You just start watching on any other device, your phone or even another TV in the house. You can start watching exactly where you left off and finish on a different device. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies or TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time for absolutely free. So try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for its support of Twit and Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Now it's time to get back to the show. Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is the show where you get to dig into a topic for an entire hour. I'd love to introduce my guest, Dr. Kelly McGonigal. She is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University and a leading expert in the mind-body relationship. She teaches for the School of Medicine's Health Improvement Program and is a senior teacher and consultant for the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Her book, The Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It, explores cutting-edge research on motivation, temptation, and addiction, as well as what it takes to make a successful change. She's also the author of Yoga for Pain Relief, Simple Practices to Calm Your Mind and Heal Your Pain. She blogs for Psychology Today and Mindful.org. She received her PhD in psychology from Stanford University with a concentration in humanistic medicine, a BA in psychology, and a BS in mass communication from Boston University. Without any further ado, love to welcome Kelly to the show. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's great to be able to get this opportunity to talk with somebody who knows about self-control.
Are there any self-control issues you're not telling me about?
Maybe a couple, one or two. It's a common human issue to have to be dealing with temptation, self-control on many levels. But what is it that got you specifically interested in this particular topic?
Well, I was working as a health educator, going around to different places and telling people what they were supposed to be doing to improve their health. And the number one response I got from people was either that they didn't want to do it or that they wanted to make the change, but they just couldn't do it. And in fact, whenever I bring up the word willpower, the most common response I get is, oh, I don't have any of that. And I realized that there was so much fascinating science about self-control and behavior change that had not made it into the public understanding yet. And people were using strategies for self-control that are not only inaccurate, but actually very counterproductive or destructive. So I decided rather than going around and telling people what they needed to do to better manage their stress or improve their health, I would teach a course on the science of willpower and let people choose their own willpower challenge. And so that's how all of this got started. And that class, The Science of Willpower, actually taught me a lot about how to translate science into real-world strategies. So I would take all of these fantastic ideas and theories and studies and try to turn them into experiments that people could do in their own life. And then sort of they'd come back the next week and they would tell me, they'd give me the data about whether this helped them with whatever their willpower challenge was. And that's how the book came about. It's basically the best of the willpower experiments, both done in the laboratory and in the experiments that my students have used in order to make a difficult change.
Yeah, I was reading the introduction to the book and you mentioned, well, none of the failed experiments actually are in the book. So it, as a result of all of the help that your students gave you in being able to fine tune what works.
That's right.
And they, in the process of determining what experiments worked and what didn't, how long did you work on it? How long have you been teaching the course and can you give any examples of some, devastatingly, devastating failures in the experiments?
Yes. So I've been teaching the class for 4 years now, and hundreds and hundreds of people have taken the class. And one of the most popular theories of willpower when I first started teaching the class was this blood glucose theory of willpower, that willpower requires blood sugar, that requires energy, which actually is probably true. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful research on how blood sugar levels influence our ability to control our attention and our emotions and our impulses. Mm-hmm. But at that particular point in time, there were all these studies coming out showing that if you drank sweetened soda or sweetened lemonade or had a little bit of candy, that it would temporarily boost your attention and your impulse control in every aspect of willpower. And so let me tell you, I did not have to even suggest this experiment to people. But as soon as my students heard that story, they decided their experiment was going to be to eat candy and drink soda as a way to keep willpower high throughout the day. And and although actually a couple people reported that it was helpful, it's such a colossally mistaken strategy in the long term. Not only because that interferes with a lot of people's willpower goals to be healthy or to lose weight, but because if you're continuously giving yourself these bursts of sugar, you're going to end up impairing your energy levels and your body's ability to control blood sugar throughout the day. So you'll have exactly the opposite effect of what was intended. But my students enjoyed doing it.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure every one of them did. Okay, so let's go back to square one and talk a bit about what willpower is.
Well, so there are two main misconceptions, I think, about willpower. And the first is that willpower is forcing yourself to do something that you don't want to do. And I define willpower as the ability to do what you really want to do, what matters most deeply to you, your goals and your values, even when it's difficult, uncomfortable, or some part of you wants to do something else. And so willpower basically is about finding strength to make a choice that is consistent with your best self rather than your most tempted self or your most anxious and stressed out and overwhelmed self. And what's been most fascinating for me to learn from the science of willpower is that this ability is fundamentally biological rather than some kind of moral virtue. I mean, a lot of us think that your willpower says something about how good a human being you are, or that it's even like a fixed personality trait that you either have or you don't have. But it seems as though everyone has this basic capacity, and that it is a kind of mind-body response, very similar to the stress fight-or-flight response. That is, when your brain detects an inner conflict, that part of you wants to do one thing and part of you wants to do another thing, the brain can shift into this state that allows you to slow down, to remember your goals, and control your impulses so that you can sort of find your strength or find your motivation.
When we're talking about willpower, what areas of the brain are actually involved in allowing us to have self-control and do what we want to do, or in some cases to go against our impulses to not do something?
Yeah. So the most important regions for self-control in the brain, and you can find them on your own head, which is what I like to have my students do, the prefrontal cortex and different areas of the prefrontal cortex. And of course, the prefrontal cortex is the area of the brain that has most recently evolved. It's larger and better connected in humans than in other species, which is, you know, one of the reasons why we are the species that is most likely to actually be able to control our impulses. And there are different regions of the prefrontal cortex that lend us different aspects of willpower. So you mentioned that willpower often requires being able to say no to something that you want. I call that I won't power. I'm not going to eat that cookie. I'm not going to smoke that cigarette. Or I'm not going to buy that new whatever. And the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex over here seems to be pretty important for that ability to basically say no, to communicate down to areas in the middle of your brain that are saying, buy me, drink me, eat me, whatever. And the other side of the frontal region, here the prefrontal cortex on the side, seems to be very important for finding your approach motivation. That is the willingness to actually do something, even though it may be a little bit aversive, like someone who has to exercise rather than stay on the couch, or someone who has to find the motivation to look at their taxes, even though they're terrified by what they might find out. So you've got the side regions of the prefrontal cortex doing that. And then the area of the brain that I think is most underappreciated in terms of the neurobiology of willpower is the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is a little bit more behind your eyes. And this area of the brain, part of its job is to keep in mind what your goals are and what it is you want. And when this area of the brain can basically hold in mind your long-term goals, it actually influences sort of the deeper systems of the brain that would usually push us towards immediate pleasure or avoiding immediate pain. And this area of the brain can actually regulate what it is you want. I call that your want power, so that you actually feel motivated to do something that may have some short-term costs, but some very big long-term rewards.
Which is very important to be able to reach particular goals, like finishing college. Say you're going for a college degree, or you want to lose a certain amount of weight, or you know, something that's much further off. There has to be something that allows you to be able to keep stuff in mind.
Yes.
In terms of the brain as a muscle. And in the book, you refer to using willpower like a muscle, that you can exercise it, you can build it up. Is there any evidence for actually changing these areas of the brain, for making for increasing activity in these areas, for example?
Yes. So there are a few different interventions that seem to most effectively increase the density and the connectivity of the prefrontal cortex, so that it's basically more efficient and it's better at doing what it's supposed to do. And people are often surprised by what the two most robust interventions are. They turn out to be meditation and physical exercise. And we don't often think about physical exercise as training the brain. We know, obviously, it's going to train the heart and it's going to train our muscles. But there's something about the demands of physical exercise that increases blood flow to the brain and the way that the brain uses energy, just like exercise changes the way your body uses energy. And so one of the best ways to actually train your brain and literally change the structure and the connectivity of your brain to better support self-control is to exercise on a regular basis. And there are even studies showing that I love studies that do a positive intervention and see a positive change, and then take away that intervention and see if there's a slide back. And so there are studies that have people who are not physically fit exercise for a period of maybe a couple of months, and then demonstrate changes in brain function as well as brain structure, and then have them not exercise and see that you can see the same kind of deteriorations in function from not exercising. And so working out is one of the best ways to train the brain. And on the other end of the spectrum, if working out feels too strenuous, meditation seems to do exactly the same as physical exercise, that it selectively is strengthening regions of the brain for self-control and also for self-awareness, which turns out to be a very important skill in order to even trigger this willpower instinct. You need to recognize an internal conflict. Your brain needs to recognize you're about to do something that is inconsistent with your long-term goals. And so being able to train self-awareness through something like meditation means that you're less likely to be walking around making choices that are automatic, that are out of habit or out of stress, so that you didn't even have an opportunity to find your willpower, because there was no moment when you recognized that willpower was needed.
Yeah, something I thought was interesting as I looked through your book was how similar so many of the techniques in the first few chapters were to mindfulness meditation. Yeah. So the awareness of things occurring.
Yes.
That personal observation. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Mindfulness has been shown not just to change the brain. So a lot of the studies that are looking at how meditation changes the brain, they're not particularly interested in willpower. And those are just straight up, you know, what happens in the brain when you meditate. Yeah. But there's a whole new emerging area of research that is looking at using mindfulness specifically to overcome willpower challenges. There's a intervention technique called mindfulness-based relapse prevention that's being used with people who struggle with alcoholism, smoking, and other drug addictions. And using the techniques of being aware of what you're thinking and feeling, learning what a craving feels like and what's likely to trigger it, and importantly, developing a sense that you are strong enough to handle these inner experiences of wanting, of craving, of stress, without having to immediately react to them by smoking or drinking or getting high. And these interventions are turning out to be more effective in many cases than traditional relapse prevention programs. And even in many studies, more effective than drug therapy, like nicotine replacement therapy for people who are trying to quit smoking. And some of my colleagues at Stanford have been using the same technique to help people overcome anxiety, which many of us don't think of as a willpower challenge. But, you know, there's not much difference between anxiety getting in your way of being able to sort of be your best self versus something like a craving getting in the way of being your best self. It's still an inner experience that pushes us towards reactivity and trying to protect ourselves in the short term rather than being able to take steps toward our long-term goals.
Yeah, so let's talk about that inner experience. With inner experience, very often there is some stimulation, some internal stimulation of the reward center, the dopaminergic reward center, that even if you're having negative depressive thoughts, there's some kind of reward that you're getting that continues you on the track of having negative thoughts. Or if you're having positive thoughts and you get that reward, it's the same thing. Or going after a drug or whatever it happens to be that stimulates it. How the pleasure center, it seems to be such a strong driver of behavior. How does the willpower or self-control aspect of the brain short-circuit that?
Well, actually, so I think one of the most important things to do first is rename the pleasure center to the promise of reward center. Because, you know, it was initially dubbed the pleasure center back in the 50s and 60s when people were observing the behavior of laboratory rats who would do anything for the opportunity to have this area of the brain stimulated electrically. And so the scientists just assumed it must feel really good to have this region of the brain stimulated. Otherwise, why would rats allow themselves to be electrocuted in order to receive it? Why would they starve to death so that they could keep stimulating this area of the brain? Mm-hmm. And what we know now is that actually when this area of the brain that we've been calling the pleasure center, but is now often referred to as the reward center, that when it's stimulated, what it produces is not so much the feeling of happiness or even the feeling of liking or pleasure, but the feeling of wanting. And wanting is actually more of an aversive state than it is a pleasurable state. But it comes with the guarantee, the seeming guarantee, that if you eat or drink or buy or do whatever the brain is orienting you towards, that it will then produce the feeling of satisfaction or the feeling of happiness, or just even the relief from the anxiety and stress that wanting generates. And so one of the first things that I have my students do who are struggling with any sort of temptation is to recognize the difference between wanting and liking, or the difference between wanting and happiness. And this reward system of the brain, it basically evolved to make sure that we would be willing to chase down food and chase down opportunities to mate. And so all this system of the brain cares about is whether it can motivate you to do work. It can motivate you to consume. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, you know, give a darn about whether or not the consequence of that produces true lasting satisfaction and happiness. It just needs to trick you into doing this thing that it thinks, you know, will help you survive. And so when people start to pay attention to what the actual experience of wanting is like, people realize that it's almost insatiable, especially if you're struggling with some sort of addiction, whether it's food or shopping or even, you know, the internet and your iPhone, that the experience of wanting is constantly triggered by this object of desire. And there's no point in time in which, you know, those Girl Scout cookies or the pizza or your iPhone that you could encounter it and not have the experience of wanting, even when you are stuffed or even when you are stressed out and, you know, there's no good email when you're checking the email, that reality doesn't seem to change the experience of wanting. And that's what makes this area of the brain so devious. But So to get back to your original question, sorry, this is such a sort of windy path.
It's fascinating, though.
That when you are aware of the difference between wanting and happiness, it actually begins to fundamentally change the way the brain is responding. And so the motto I always tell my students is, if you can see it, you can see through it. And as soon as you are, your view of what's happening in your own brain and body is just a little bit more expansive, you have a little bit more perspective on it, it actually is already shifting the brain into a state where your prefrontal cortex will then be able to remember what it is you really want, and help you find the self-control or the motivation to do something consistent with those goals.
When thinking about where the brain strength, the inner strength to develop more self-control comes from, there are experiments that show that kids who are unable to resist a marshmallow treat, that they don't have the control to the self-control to wait 2 minutes to eat the special sweet treat, they have self-control problems going forward into adulthood. Is that a path that people are is it predetermined? Are people just destined to have poor impulse control, or can they change that?
Well, so this is a question I get all the time. It does seem to be the case that people are born with sort of differing abilities to delay gratification and control their impulses, and that those differences do emerge in childhood, and so that's why they're so predictive of things later on in life. But I feel like focusing on the sort of the inborn individual differences really doesn't get us very far. And one thing that we know for sure is that all of these things are trainable, so that wherever you are on the spectrum, you know, even if you are born with a certain predisposition toward addiction, for example, and we know there are some genetic bases or early life experiences that shape that. Even if you're predisposed to addiction, doesn't mean that you will develop addiction or that you can't recover from addiction. And even in cases of extreme addicts who have brain damage in their prefrontal cortex because of the drugs that they've consumed, even in those extreme cases, research suggests that interventions that train prefrontal cortex functioning, a little bit of basically neuropsychological games and tests that you can use as a training, that things like that, as well as mindfulness and meditation, can actually help restore self-control, even when it seems like sort of all hope is lost. And even in, you know, this classic study of Phineas Gage, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the story. Yeah. About this this railroad worker who had a railroad spike or a tamping iron go all the way through his brain and destroy his prefrontal cortex. Everyone right. uses that story as an example of how important the prefrontal cortex is for self-control. But there are stories that later on in life, even though he did not have his prefrontal cortex anymore, that because he found a community that he fit into well, he ended up being able to function very normally in society and become a productive member of society when he found this sort of community that provided the structure. That to me, I mean, basically when I hear people who want to focus, and this is not necessarily you, but this happens all the time in my classes, who want to say, but you know, some people just are born without willpower. Some people are just born with more willpower. Although scientifically it's true and it's interesting, that's the genetic basis, because I'm a kind of a pragmatist with this material, I just want people to take the step that's going to allow them to be the best version of themselves. And when it comes to parenting, you know, there's no evidence that you can't have a positive influence on your child's ability to delay gratification and learn these techniques. In fact, I've had a number of parents start to bring their very young kids into my Science of Willpower class and apply these same strategies that that they're using to deal with their own willpower challenges, their kids are using to deal with overcoming anxiety about homework and spelling tests and baseball games and, you know, learning time management and all of that.
Yeah, I actually think I had better self-control when I was a kid than I do as an adult. As I've gotten older, I've become much more lenient with myself. So,
well, and you know what? That is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, one of the mistakes we often make is thinking that that we need to control everything in our lives, or maybe we adopt certain standards of behavior that other people or media tells us we should be doing. And one of the things we do know about aging is that people have a harder time doing things they don't actually care about. And from my point of view, that can be a good thing because, you know, a big part of willpower is being able to focus your energy, your time, and your self-control on the things that you actually care about. And that may mean giving up on controlling or perfecting some things that might matter to someone else, but just don't matter to you.
Right. In terms of the how things matter, what matters in modern society is completely different from what matters, what mattered, you know, when our brains were really developing and our cultural behaviors were developing. And you mentioned earlier, you know, the survival instinct, what willpower was for years and years and years ago, is it necessarily the same now? And so how do we, you know, I guess that what I'm asking is there are these old pathways in our brain, but how do we use them for this new situation of life in a technological age?
Well, I think probably the biggest difference is the fact that when our capacity for willpower was evolving, it was kind of a short-term strategy in the same way that our stress response was a short-term strategy for survival, that you would see a predator and you'd have to run. And so it was very helpful to have a mind-body response that allowed you to protect yourself. And willpower seems to be very similar, that it's meant to be a short-term strategy where maybe you have the impulse to physically hurt a member of your tribe, and you need to control that impulse so that you don't get kicked out of the tribe and end up starving. You know, the ability to control our impulses probably was an adapted solution to living in community. But we didn't have that 24-hour a day stimulation and distraction and temptation that we have now. So we have this capacity that is basically meant to be a short-term strategy to deal with occasional conflicts that now we are forced to use almost 24 hours a day because we have the opportunity to be triggered by so many things in our environment, as well as our even more complex relationships with others now. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is helpful is to realize that you don't need to use willpower for everything that we might think that willpower is needed for. So for an example, many of us, we don't make our choices about what we're going to eat until we are staring at the menu and we're starving. And yet you can actually make some choices in advance before you need willpower. If I pack a healthy lunch before I go to work, and then I have that lunch at my desk, it takes less willpower to eat the healthy lunch than it would to go out for lunch, and certainly a lot less willpower than it would take to order something healthy when I'm staring at a bunch of junk food that is more appealing in that moment. So there are some ways to set up default. Same thing with, you know, investing in retirement. Why use your willpower to save money when you can do it once, you know, set what's taken out of your paycheck and never have to use willpower for that again. So in some ways, the strategies we need are to be able to take something that could use willpower and look for ways to make it a default or make it automatic so that we are not wasting our willpower on that.
Because willpower is it a limited resource in our brain?
It is a limited resource. It does seem as though when you use your willpower, the brain gets temporarily fatigued or it just becomes a little bit less willing to exert itself. So nobody can basically control everything that they think and say and do all day long. And the brain needs an opportunity to kind of restore itself, which doesn't mean indulgence, but it does mean not having to be so tightly vigilant about what's in your environment and what you're thinking and doing and feeling.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that we have these ideas that we have to control everything in our lives, but that can actually backfire, and that's in this sense. This is the sense that can backfire, where you're using so much willpower, you have none by the end of the day.
Yeah, and what we see is actually a rebound effect. I mean, one of the more poignant examples of that I see all the time in undergraduates here at Stanford, sort of two types of rebound. There are a lot of young girls who are really concerned about their appearance and what they eat, mm-hmm. and they are expending tremendous willpower exercising compulsively, counting every calorie, having a list of 9,000, you know, bad foods they're not allowed to eat, and making sure that they fit into a certain image. And then are actually drained of willpower when it comes to something like academic coursework or weekend parties. And there's some evidence that the sort of the more tightly wound up people are in using their willpower for something like controlling what they eat, or even studying, sort of, you know, spending all of their willpower trying to be the number one student and do above and beyond in every possible area, that they're more likely to binge drink and they're more likely to have sexual indiscretions that they later regret.
Got it.
On the weekend, because they've kind of exhausted their willpower resources. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about with undergraduates is how do you prioritize and how do you find a middle path so that you don't end up making mistakes that are going to end up being a lot more consequential than whether you got an A minus versus an A on some paper or test.
Right. Actually putting things in perspective. In a life view as opposed to a right now view. So what about the difference between the right now frame of mind, where everything is instant gratification, versus long-term goal setting?
Yeah, well, so this is, I mean, that's the basic difference between being in that one mindset where you're motivated by stress and by immediate reward versus the long-term mindset. I think one of the things that that many people don't appreciate is that there are actually these two forms of motivation. And if you look at some of the more current science of willpower or science of behavior change, there's a lot of interest in trying to game the system of immediate gratification to force people to do things that actually have positive long-term consequences. Like you're going to reward yourself with some immediate treat if you exercise or you work on something that you were procrastinating. And I actually think that that can end up backfiring if you're trying to continuously motivate yourself from the system of the brain and the type of motivation that really is going to just point you off into the wrong direction most of the time. You're strengthening a brain response, and you're strengthening a mindset that is going to be in conflict with your goals most of the time. And so this other mindset that, again, is more characterized by activation here in the prefrontal cortex, that want power area of the brain, in order to be in that mindset and be just as strongly motivated, but not from this desire for immediate gratification, that often requires starting to think about the future in a different way. Or even thinking about the future at all. One of the more interesting studies I've seen had people imagine themselves grocery shopping like a month in the future. And the grocery shopping had nothing to do with the test of self-control they were interested in. But there was just something about imagining being in the future and knowing that that was going to be real. That 1 month from now, you were going to have a real experience and it was going to be you that was making choices and you that was going to be buying things. To understand sort of the continuity of ourself across time gave people more self-control in the present. And so that's something that I'm encouraging people to do. And some of my students are actually doing this with their kids as a first strategy for training willpower, is to start to get to know the future self and to really believe that you're going to be the one who is living the consequences of your actions. And it turns out that many of us, we actually feel like our future self is a total stranger. And so like, why would I save money for a stranger? Because we don't understand that we are actually going to be experiencing benefits, or that we are the one who's going to have to go through chemotherapy, if we continue to smoke. There's this disconnect. And so strengthening that connection or that continuity turns out to give people more willpower for all sorts of choices related to health and finances and relationships.
I wonder how that relates to the adolescent brain. Because the adolescent brain has a less than mature prefrontal cortex. The adolescent is making impulsive decisions. Hormones are kicking in that are causing changes in the way that area of the brain connects to other areas of the brain. How does it relate?
First of all, let me just say that when I finally understood the neuroscience of the teenage brain, I appreciated how overprotective my parents were. They barely let me out of the house. And I didn't think that was right at the time. But looking back, I understand a little bit better what that was about. It's true. So we do know that the prefrontal cortex continues to develop into your, sometimes even your mid-20s for men. So the brain is getting better and better as we age at controlling our impulses and our attention and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, around that hormonal shift in adolescence, while your prefrontal cortex is starting to catch up, at the same time, all the systems of desire, and particularly the desire to fit in with others, the sort of the social brain, is becoming much more active, much more dominant. So even though the prefrontal cortex is continuing to catch up, it can't compete often with this huge increase in sexual desire and the desire to fit in and the intensity of emotions and of stress. And this is, you know, it's why teenagers take incredibly stupid risks. And it's not just kids being illogical. Because, you know, the way that the brain is set up during adolescence, it actually seems more important to have your friend's approval in that moment than to minimize your risk of getting into a car crash, say, for texting while driving or being drunk while driving. And they actually are making logical choices. They just have different priorities.
Different logic rules. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything in your classes with adolescents, with teenagers, and the strategies that you suggest for controlling willpower?
I would say that the number one thing that has been helpful for my younger undergraduates, and the thing that when parents ask me, well, what should I do with my teenager? Because you can't force them to have self-control. Is to cultivate self-compassion, which is it's a sort of a two sides of self-compassion. One is to start develop a kind of confidence in yourself that you will be able to handle difficult situations, and that when you are in the face of something that maybe makes you anxious or that makes you doubt yourself or that requires a lot of you, that actually you will be able to find the strength and the skills and the resources to survive that. And often that includes social support. I mean, to trust that you have relationships with people who will support you through difficult times. So that's kind of one side of self-compassion, is a kind of inner trust of yourself. But the other side is not being overly self-critical, especially in the face of failure. And this is something that teens do not get a lot of training in, partly because for the last decade or so, teachers and parents have been really trying to protect their kids from failure experiences. You know, that nobody gets a bad grade, nobody gets kicked off the sports team, everyone gets a prize. And you need to learn how to handle failure experiences. When you look at adult self-control and people who end up having a lot of problems with addiction, with binge eating, with all of the things that you might really want to protect your kids from, they are the most likely to believe that their failures say something unique about what is fundamentally broken with them. And so if they overeat, they break their diet, they're filled with shame rather than simple regret. Or if they gamble and lose money, same thing, that they're filled with shame, that this says something about who they are and that it is unfixable. And so if you can help as a young person, if you can start to cultivate some more self-compassion by understanding how human it is to make mistakes, how human it is to experience temptation, or if you can have that attitude towards your own kid, your own teenager, while still setting structure to support them, but to not instill this kind of deep shame and self-doubt that teenagers often acquire when they let down themselves, where they let down their parents or they let down their mentors, it's a very special opportunity to either instill this shame and self-doubt that is not helpful, or really teach kids that failure and letting others down and letting yourself down are part of the process of life. And that you can develop some resilience toward it.
In your book, you talk a lot about taking a scientific approach to your own life. Can you explain that strategy and what you mean by that?
Yeah, I want people to be willpower scientists. And so I always say, like, there are two ways to be a scientist. One is you can just observe. Lots of sciences are descriptive, and you really want to investigate what's going on. So I give a lot of assignments to, like, really investigate how does how much sleep you get influence the decisions that you make later in the day? And can you start to see that relationship? Or, you know, what are the cues in your environment that are most likely to trigger a behavior you want to change? And I call that just putting yourself under the microscope. The other type of assignment that I encourage people to do are actual experiments. So let's say that you observe that getting less than 6 hours of sleep a night makes you way more likely to do something that you want to change. Well, what happens if you change your sleep schedule? Can you actually change your behavior? And with those experiments, you can start to collect your own data and find out what works for you. And I think, you and I have a basic appreciation for statistics. And we understand that when we see a study, we know that we're looking at an average effect rather than a sort of guarantee. And I think that's right. One of the most important scientific ideas that most people in the public don't actually have. And part of these willpower assignments to look at things under the microscope and to try experiments is meant to communicate this really important idea that when you read a study, for some people in that study, the opposite was true. For some people in that study, it was a little bit true. For some people, for a lot of people, it was, you know, medium true. And for some mm-hmm. people, it's incredibly true. And, you know, those people, you make this experiment, you make this change, and it's going to totally change their lives. But you don't know where on that normal curve you are. And that's why it's so important when we hear things in the media, you know, we read scientific papers, that we have to be willing to find out where we are on that normal distribution.
Where do you lie in terms of your willpower and controlling it in that normal distribution and the success of your experiments?
I have to say that if you were to break up the I will, the I won't, and the I want powers of willpower, I have always been pretty good at the I won't power. I'm pretty good at regulating my behavior, sort of controlling the impulses. Mm-hmm. I have, as a child, we're looking at sort of like genetically where on that curve. I'm way on the don't have enough of it side of the curve for I willpower. I was very anxious as a child, very shy. And like, if you gave me the opportunity to hide under my bed covers, I would have been there all day long. And so that's the aspect of willpower. I've had to bump myself up through things like mindfulness training and through things like physical exercise has been so important for me for cultivating I willpower, because exercise is all about literally finding the energy to keep going in the face of discomfort or fatigue. And then in terms of I want power, that's also something that I feel like now I've actually gotten much better at it, that I feel sort of in most choices in everyday life, I feel more motivated by my values rather than immediate gratification. And so those two sides of willpower are the ones that I've had to cultivate more intentionally in my own life.
So for you, the process is actually personally working as well.
Yeah. It really has. And one of the reasons that I kept teaching this class, I mean, yeah, the enrollments were great. So I knew that people wanted it. But boy, is it helpful to talk about this stuff all the time and to be forced to remind myself of how important it is to take care of my body if I want my brain to be working well, how important it is to have social support, have self-compassion, to say these things, you know, every day. And to hear it reflected back to me in the stories of my students is one of the things that helps me stay committed to it in my own life.
And I saw a tweet on your website that some strategy involving a tomato you used to finish your dissertation.
Yeah. When something is very overwhelming, it can be easy to become an anxiety procrastinator where you're just like, I can't figure out how it's all going to happen, so I'm not going to do anything at all. And I took a dissertation writing workshop a long time ago where her main advice was you just have to commit to working in 45-minute increments, and then 15 minutes of every hour, you have to do something that I think she used the word like feed your way, something that that doesn't feel as overwhelming as writing the dissertation. And I took that strategy of saying I'm going to do, you know, 5 units or 9 units a day of these 45-minute work periods, and then following that, I get 15 minutes of dancing or spending time with a friend or, you know, whatever is going to feel like, you know, a really nice break. And it got me through the dissertation. It got me through writing this lovely book, The Willpower Instinct.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I saw that Dan Pink tweeted about that as a productivity tool. And it's an example of a very minor willpower hack that actually can just help us stay focused on our goals. It doesn't give you motivation, but if you are motivated, it helps you remember and use your motivation.
A simple trick to be more productive. We are just about at the end of the show, and I really want to thank you for your time today. It's been very educational, very interesting. And for anyone who is interested, your book is The Willpower Instinct. Your website, kellymcgonigal.com. Yes, that's the cover of the book. You can also find it on Audible. You can get it online. I'm sure there's probably a Kindle version as well for those of you who like to read the digital stuff. In terms of the class that you teach, is it only at Stanford, or can people access that through the web as well? I know Stanford is starting to offer some courses virtually.
Right now, the Science of Willpower class at Stanford is not available online, but I will be teaching a course through the company Sounds True. It's going to be a live class starting in September that is called either the Neuroscience of Change or something that's basically about how to use compassion and mindfulness to make a difficult change in your life. So people who are interested in the class can take a different version of it, but one that would be a really good complement to reading the book, and that'll be through soundstrue.com.
SoundsTrue.com. Thank you once again. This has just been fabulous. I look forward. I hope we send lots of people in the direction of your materials, because this seems like the science of willpower just seems like it's using science to help us in our daily lives, help us be better people. And through what you've written and what you teach, it's probably going to help a lot of people.
I hope so. It's helped me.
That's good. And with yourself, that's where you have to start right here. So everybody, that does it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour this week. I am Dr. Kiki. And until next week, I hope that you will follow my other sciencey pursuits. You can catch me on Twitter at Dr. Kiki. I'm drkiki.tv is my website. My Facebook page is Dr. Kiki. I'm Kiki Sanford on Google+. You can subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour in iTunes, or you can go to twit.tv/Kiki for more episodes of this program. And if you need more science goodness, maybe you can't give an hour a week, set aside an hour a week to listening to this program. 5 minutes or so. The top part of the show is dedicated to science news, and we've spun off a new, very brief weekly podcast called Science News Weekly, so that you can just catch the news and know what's going on in the science world using just a very very, very small amount of your time every week. Next week, we're going to be talking about nuclear energy and Fukushima 1 year later. I hope that you will join me next week for another interesting conversation. Remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week, and I do hope that this hour makes your world a whole lot more interesting. And now, for your science meditation of the week.
Thanks to recent breakthroughs in stem cell biology, we can now grow stem cells, even brain neural stem cells like those shown here, from adult skin cells. With their unique capacity to renew themselves and to give rise to the body's many different cell types, stem cells have the potential to repair tissues that are damaged by disease or injury. In the future, these cells might be used for personalized cell replacement therapies, drug screening, and drug delivery. Importantly, these cells also enable us to ask basic biological questions about how cells make decisions.